Okay, good morning. We're going to call the tax committee to order. Good morning, members. We're just waiting for a quorum, and so folks are in other committees, and they're going to try to send them down so that we can actually move the work of Rep. Mark Hortner from planning. But good morning. Please tell us about House Bill 2367, which we cannot yet move.
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Lanning and I are here to present House File 2367, which is an effort to provide kind of an aggressive response dealing with the housing market for those border cities that were impacted by this leaf and flood. And as you know, and I appreciate all the members' concerns and actually all of your communities that came into the Fargo-Moorhead area to help the sandbag and do whatever. There's law enforcement from Hennepin County, Ramsey, all over the place that came in. So appreciate all the members' districts and all their help for all that. But in late March, the Fargo-Moorhead area hit a 40.82-foot crest, which was almost a foot and a half higher than 1997, and it was 0.7 foot over the all-time record of 40.1. And through the heroic efforts of our volunteers and sandbaggers and law enforcement and city officials up and down the Red River Valley, we were able to, the dikes held, and we were able, for the most part, to protect the cities. And in the area, there were about 6 million sandbags put down. And if you laid those sandbags edge to edge, they would go about 2,300 miles long. That's how many sandbags are filled and put down. Despite those great efforts, there were about hundreds of homes that were damaged. There was millions of dollars of infrastructure damage and roads and streets and so forth. And FEMA and hopefully the recovery bill we have and the mitigation efforts will deal with most of that. But when all the cleanup's all done and all the sandbags are gone, we do have some real serious concerns dealing with a weakened housing market. And there's a couple things with that. Just the idea of the flood and the fact that people are fatigued from fighting the flood, but also some may be weary of purchasing a home in the Red River Valley. And so we just have to look to North Dakota to see what they're doing to know what we're up against. And just this legislative session in North Dakota ended yesterday or the day before, but a couple of the things they did was they put in about $300 million into buying down the school property taxes, about $300 million. That will lower property taxes 15% to 20%. And that really, you've heard me talk about this before, was probably the competitive advantage we had with North Dakota. We're probably going to lose that. They also are throwing a lot of dollars towards the flood relief. And they also have an exemption, which they now have up to $150,000 property tax exemption of market value. And so what this bill does, it takes an aggressive stance towards the housing market to help keep Minnesota border cities in the game, so to speak. And very quickly, what it does, before I turn this over to Representative Lanning.
Representative Markford, I'm going to go ahead and you're going to move House File. We now have a quorum. Okay, Representative Markford now moves House File 2367. And Representative Markford now moves the amendment H2367DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order he would like it. Discussion of the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment's adopted. Representative Markford.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The three main things this bill does is it applies to those in the Border Cities program who are in a flood disaster declared area. So that's where it's limited to. What it does, it will abate or exempt the first $150,000 of market value for any new construction for 2 years, and will exempt $20,000 per unit for multifamily for 2 years. There's abatement for 2 years, and it will be for the two assessment years after construction has begun. So with that, turn this over to Representative Lanning.
Morning, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate very much your willingness to hear this this bill. Having lived through many floods over the last 40 years in our community, I can tell you that our area is frankly exhausted from what we've been through. It's been a very difficult situation. I was mayor of Moorhead during the 1997 flood, and I remarked at the time that I didn't expect to have to live through anything like that again in my lifetime. Well, as it turned out, it was a very short lifetime, because it was only 12 years ago that we had the other kind of flood that we've had. The impact on our community and area has been very substantial, and I think you're receiving a handout that has some very big numbers on it in terms of the impact on the city of Moorhead. The city has expended so far $2.1 million, total estimated expenditures of $5 million, damages to public infrastructure $20 million, and estimated flood mitigation needs $20 million. That's just one city of all kinds of cities that have been impacted in this year's flood. And so we have a very daunting challenge ahead of us, and I would echo Representative Marquardt's comments about the importance of this bill and the importance of being able to keep our housing market stable and moving forward. The city of Moorhead in recent years has been successful in bringing new housing development into our community. We've had a distinct advantage on the property tax side, where property taxes in Moorhead on the same house have been about half of what they have been in North Dakota and Fargo. But as Representative Marquardt pointed out, that's soon to change significantly. And we're very concerned about being able to stay in the game, so to speak, with regard to attracting housing development in our community. So we appreciate your willingness to consider this proposal, which I think will have a very significant impact. We are meeting later today with the Conference Committee on the Bonding Bill to talk about the flood mitigation needs that our community and area has, as well as the flood relief bill that Representative Marquardt and I and others have authored, and that bill will be considered as a part of the bonding bill. I also want to mention that just came back last night from a quick trip to Washington, D.C. We had a historic meeting. It's the first time in my 35 years of public service where I've seen the two governors, Governor of Minnesota and North Dakota, the congressional delegation from Minnesota, congressional delegation from North Dakota, and a bunch of local leaders and state officials, Corps of Engineers, people coming together talking about where we go from here in trying to respond to this flood. Obviously, we talked about some of the things that need to be done in the short term and things that are going to need to be done in the long term, and it was a very productive meeting, and we had lots of media interest and coverage, and I think the ball is rolling for the state and federal governments to be working hand in glove to help us respond to this major flooding crisis that we've had. So with that, Madam Chair and members, we have a couple of experts here from Moorhead that can fill in some more of the details.
Please, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Scott Hutchins, Community Service Director for the City of Moorhead. Lisa Bottenstall, Neighborhood Services Manager for the City of Moorhead. And thank you so much for taking time this morning. The recovery process, the post-flood recovery process, is underway. 8 miles of clay dikes are being taken down. $2.5 million sandbags are being removed, and we have inspected to date about 300 homes that have either called in with damage or are homes located in the floodplain where we anticipate there has been some damage. Lisa has on a list that we have invited folks that have an interest in selling their properties on a voluntary basis. We have about 70 homeowners who have expressed interest. So our post-flood recovery efforts are well underway, and we thank you so much for all that you have done and your colleagues and the networks that you share around the state have done for Moorhead and others in our region during this time. We learned an important lesson post-1997 flood, and that is, first, that there is some fear, trepidation, and hesitancy for consumers and those making housing decisions in a market that has just undergone the kind of event that we did. Furthermore, that those fears can also turn into or have a competitive factor to them. And what we discovered in post-97 is not only did our housing starts diminish, were reduced, but also the state of North Dakota and the city of Fargo, by means and allocations of resources that they had available to them, did some extraordinary things to bolster the housing market in their community. And so in the materials that we've presented, we've noted that we characterize this as both a competitive threat and a confidence threat, a confidence in the market and a competitive matter with our neighbors to the west. And the tools and resources that were directed went to provide those interested home buyers opportunity to get into the Fargo housing market. And at that time also was made available the tax exemption that is the subject of the discussion here today. So we are hopeful that we might turn back any of the competitive forces that might rise up in this post-flood environment and have a good or at least a stable construction season on the residential side, as it is such an important part of Moorhead's economy for this year and next year. And I would like to turn it over to Lisa Vattenfall for some additional remarks and then respond to any questions you might have.
Morning, welcome.
Good morning, thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you've been hearing this morning, we are concerned about what happened in 1997 and intending to work as diligently as we can to prevent that same situation from happening again in our housing market. While fewer homes were damaged in Moorhead than some other communities in 1997, Moorhead did suffer losses, and we do believe that it was related primarily to the market. And the results of those are that in the 2000 census, Moorhead's population declined by 118 people. However, Fargo's population grew 20%. Now, it didn't all happen in that three-year period, but we do believe that that had an impact. They made all the resources of the state of North Dakota available at that time. Our tax base, we are targeting new construction at this point in time too, because after the 1997 flood, Moorhead's construction rate went down 32% in the year following the flood. So we know we have an issue with confidence, and we know we have an issue with competition. And I'm certain that you're well aware of the challenging housing market throughout the state and throughout the nation. But this property tax exemption is an opportunity for Moorhead to compete with its border city, North Dakota, where people in the marketplace are making decisions based on a number of different factors, and they are choosy buyers. We have two real choosy buyers. And the issue with the border city issue is that Minnesota communities that are not facing that North Dakota Minnesota border communities, the state of Minnesota benefits from the entire choice that the person makes, and that does not happen when someone chooses to live in North Dakota. So we would really appreciate any opportunities that you have to assist us for this two-year period. We recognize that this is not something that's afforded to every community in Minnesota, and so we would like to recognize that and try to use this two-year period to recover our housing market, because we were doing really good things before the flood.
Great, thank you. Mr. Marker, I should amend your motion, I guess, if you need to go to Ways and Means.
Oh, okay.
I guess there's about a $2 million price tag, so somebody will have to find that money.
Very good.
So,
just very quickly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that this next 2 years are crucial on whether or not we fall behind or if we stay in the game. And besides the city of Moorhead, this will also impact the cities of Breckenridge, Dilworth, and East Grand Forks, who have also experienced the same type of things after the flood of 97.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we're going to adjourn in just or not adjourn, recess in just a few minutes to get to the floor. Rep. Sandy Flint? Sure, yeah, please.
Just curious, what on a $200,000 house, what would this mean in terms of a benefit that they would see for the next year?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Eastland, 200,000 tax capacity, the 2,000, your average rate for 130%, I suppose. About 2,600, okay, I don't know, we're at 150. About $2,000, I would say, would be the benefit.
Annually?
Annually, for 2 years, yeah.
And I guess you've thought about this. How would this affect the real estate market for people who are selling their homes? It seems like it could have a pretty significant effect on someone who maybe is moving away for some reason, maybe unrelated to the flood, but they've got a house they want to sell, and all of a sudden there's a benefit there for building new versus buying old.
Madam Chair, good question, and no doubt there will be some of that residual impact in the market. The city also has an investment in service and developed and available lots and subdivisions, and so from the perspective that such lots are built upon and those special assessments are then moved over from the public to the private side of the ledger, that benefits all taxpayers and all residents of the community by having those payments made through ad valorem taxes versus a levy. So it's a balancing act, and I think to the extent the entire community was engaged in this effort to fight this fight, I believe for the most part everyone was, I think you're going to see a variety of attempts, strategies, and solutions to pinpoint certain segments in an attempt to respond. And hopefully one will view it as a response that benefits the entire community.
And just going back historically, since you've got a 12-year comparison here that's pretty recent in history, what happened 12 years ago is in terms of people leaving the community because of the flood, and is that going to be duplicated at this point in time or not?
Mr. Hudson.
Madam Chair, members, I don't know. We were on the approaching the 2000 census at the time that showed the kind of numbers that Lisa Vattenfall indicated. It is hard to tell. We are hopeful that that's not the result. There will be, and we noted, there are a number of homes in the floodplain throughout Moorhead. There have been individuals who have expressed an interest for whatever reason, either damaged or we're just not going to fight this fight again, expressed an interest to sell their property on a voluntary basis. If that transaction occurs, it's always difficult to know what the next step will be. So I think it's unknown at this time.
Thank you. Representative Garner, and then we're going to recess. Representative Garner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And forgive me if this is an insensitive question because I don't understand the local situation very well, but all I have is the bill summary and the bill to go off of. And I guess I'd ask the blunt question is, you know, are we subsidizing the construction of homes or structures in areas that maybe we shouldn't have structures in?
Representative Mark Carter Lanning.
In the future.
Well, Representative Gardner and Madam Chair, I appreciate that question. No, I mean, what we're doing here, as statistics showed in all these communities, there was a loss in the housing market and a weakening in the housing market following the flood. This is just to keep us on a level playing field with what's happening. Otherwise, you're going to see a loss in the housing market and population probably if we don't have some sort of incentive to combat this.
And Lanning? Mr. Hutt?
Madam Chair, new homes as they're constructed in the community are built to elevations and not in the floodplain. And so from that perspective, we could be assured that that will not happen.
Okay, thank you. We're going to call for, we're going to renew Representative Markworth's motion here to, as amended, to send 2367 to Ways and Means. Discussion? Other public testimony. Forgot to ask for that. Nope. Okay, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carries. And you're off to Ways and Means. Thank you, members. We're in recess until after the floor, and it looks like we cannot use this room, so follow your emails and we'll know what room we're in later. Thank you. We're in recess.
Madam Chair, Member Sullivan.
Sorry, I'm going to call the tax committee back to order. Members, I'm having a difficult problem here at the moment. I'm trying to convene this meeting. They would like me to present the public finance bill in Ways and Means, and they need me for results in finance. So, I really don't want to miss the testimony on this bill, so I don't know if folks would prefer to recess for 10 minutes or have someone else chair this meeting. I'll actually miss the testimony then, but. And we have a thought, yes? I wouldn't even like to present the public finance bill in Ways and Means. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm going to recess for 10 minutes. I apologize. I'll be right back. Now, the health file was just introduced, I believe, yesterday. The chief author is Representative Kurtz. And so we had scheduled this ahead of time as we wanted to understand it, because Senator Black told us in conference committee that his intention was to pass it through taxes, which I believe they did today. They're going to pass it off the floor, and he intends to put it into the tax conference committee. So members will be interested to know that this provision, at least from the Senate's perspective, is intended to be part of the debate. So we want to get our members to all understand it so we know where we would be at the House. Because this bill did not make deadline, and so we're now going to hear it just to understand what's in it. So, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Representative Rucheski and members of the committee. My name is Nick Anfang. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Building Trades. And in that capacity, as far as this bill goes, I am one of the co-chairs of the Jobs Coalition. The Jobs Coalition is not an official group that's sanctioned by anybody. It's a group of people who about four and a half months ago started to get together as a very small group of concerned folks that work in the construction industry. I happen to represent construction workers, and there are developers that are required. There are labor, real estate lawyers, architects and designers and suppliers and general contractors and subcontractors, all of which are necessary to make up a quality and successful construction project. And in our early discussions, it was very apparent that the federal stimulus dollars that have been made available to help jumpstart the American economy are very welcome and important to stimulating our economy again, and I seem to be working a little bit. But in the terms of the construction industry, those stimulus dollars and those stimulus activities primarily affect what's called horizontal construction. Highways, roads, bridges, water treatment facilities, things like that. Very, very little of the stimulus package coming out of the federal government funneled through the states is helping, or appears that it will help, vertical construction, which is probably 70 to 75% of the construction industry in the state of Minnesota. So consequently, on the labor side, we are at somewhere, depending on craft, somewhere between 35 to 45% unemployed. And that's going to get worse, and it's going to continue for a long time. There are members who have been unemployed for a year and a half, some even longer. So this activity here through this bill and this coalition was to figure out just, and in the discussions with the coalition, that unemployment rate is similar in all aspects of the industry, from the highly professional architectural firms, to the legal firms, to the contractors, in-house people. We've had unheard of layoffs of in-house people in major contracting groups. But the huge concern, 10 to 12% of the economy is affected here, with 50 to 60% of those people laid off. It's a big part of the economy that's very negatively affected. So the group got together. These people should work. They're professionals. They're really good at what they do. They're losing their houses, they're losing their insurance, their bills aren't being paid. Those people that have been fortunate enough to continue to work are working short hours. And the group felt we need to try and do something. So we started to meet and grow. We grew from just a few people to over 60 individuals that come to meetings twice a week to discuss where to go and what to do. And we put down just a whole bunch of ideas initially, and those ideas were talked about, bounced around, and we finally started to say, well, some will, some won't, some will be a priority, some will work against it, this and that, and we worked it down to the point where we have what's in the bill, 2078, right now. We think the items that are in here, if enacted, certainly will jumpstart a significant amount of construction, vertical construction in the state of Minnesota, and put people beyond the building trades members, but all the professionals I talked about, start putting them back to work. And so we have been able to learn through our research that there is somewhere between $3 to $5 billion worth of construction that is latent at this time. It's laying on the table, it's shovel ready, there's no activity. It is primarily because of the financial crunch that's occurred, and the bankers and the regulators are not, I don't think we'll let you guys go into the detail on that, but I'm not the expert on that at all. But I have been part of it from day one. That's the real problem. I'm going to let Bill go through the bill a little bit more and tell you about the things that this coalition thinks, if enacted, will greatly benefit the state.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Anything. Welcome, Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Bill Griffin. I'm with the Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. My role has been just to help collect ideas, work with some of the other attorneys and developers in drafting provisions. And really, it was the effort of over 70 folks who had good ideas, brought them to the table. We winnowed them down. We took them through some of the state agencies. We met with folks in the governor's office. We wanted to understand kind of what was the package that should come forward. And really, the package that came forward has about 10 provisions in it. Things as simple as extending building permits for a year. I think the city of Minneapolis has already done this on their own, but essentially saying we've got a stack of building permits that folks aren't picking up because they don't have financing for projects, would it make sense to advance those by 1 year so you don't basically start over when funding is available. One of the more complicated provisions is a loan guarantee fund. And it was really patterned after something that was done in the late 70s, early 80s with the Minnesota Family Housing Fund, when multiple family housing was basically at a standstill. The state, McKnight, and others created a fund to get family housing going again. And so there's a loan guarantee concept where the state would be one of the actors, perhaps putting up as much as $100 million into a loan guarantee fund, which would then be used to be a credit enhancement for certain projects. And that's really kind of indicative of the type of thing that's needed, because lenders are willing to lend, but at lower ratios of loan to value. And so if loan to value was 80%, in a typical financing scenario, is maybe 55 or 60% today. And these are good projects that were ready to go that can cash flow, and so they don't really need cash as much as they need credit in order to be funded. The coalition put together a list of projects that could go forward, at least at a dollar value. They're somewhat concerned about the proprietary nature of the information, so they put together a dollar value of projects that could go forward under some scenario, and it's between $3 and $5 billion worth of construction projects, all over the state. I mean, basically, every corner of the state has something that could go forward if there was credit available. And so each of the stimulus ideas is intended to close the gap on private construction projects, not state highway projects, not sewer projects, not water treatment projects, but private construction projects. And what you get from a private construction project is you get leverage. Because you take a small bit of credit, you leverage that for a private loan, and then you're able to get construction on perhaps a dollar investment of 10 to 1. And so there's obviously significant leverage in private development. Now, one of the questions that we're always asked is, well, when these projects go forward without these credit enhancements, without these tools? Maybe in a minority where you could say yes. But if you ask you to look at the leading indicator, the leading physical indicator is the construction cranes that do not show up on the horizon. Just last year when we were meeting at this time, there were construction projects, hospital projects particularly in St. Paul. All those cranes have now come down, and what's happening is no cranes are going up to replace them. There are very, very few projects other than the horizontal construction. And so this bill and these measures are intended to close the gap, not essentially to finance a private project, but to close the gap, to create credit enhancements that will secure those private dollars to build private projects. And in doing so, there's a number of public benefits. Of course, people go back to work. When people go back to work, they pay the state tax dollars. When people buy, contracting companies buy construction equipment, they pay the state tax dollars, and so on. And so everybody we talk to understands the need to get people back to work in order to create those public benefits. If you like, we can go page by page through the bill. I'm looking at it, and I don't know if the members have the second engrossment of Senate File 2078.
Members, we don't. We do not know what the Senate did today, so you're going to need to tell us. And we, in this committee, we tend to work off the summaries, and we provide summaries, I guess, to the testifiers. I think it's easier for members to look at the summary rather than all the pages.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I believe I have the summary.
Okay, so, and where there, when because I heard that. Oh. Mr. Michael, you want to explain what's going on here?
Madam Chair, the summary is of the House file, which is the bill is introduced. The bill that you have in your packets is the first engrossment of the Senate file, and what I understand is there now is a second engrossment of the Senate file, so the summary is like two generations behind the current version. Having quickly read over the first engrossment, I can see, you know, a bunch of very material differences from the bill as introduced.
Maybe we need to get the second engrossment copy. Can we? Obviously, we both have it.
Staff would
like. Yes. So, and maybe we'll just start it and if. If we can get that copy and then just come back up as we're going, but I guess we have a summary and you can try to tell us what's in and what's out, but you know, it's okay to tell us what you propose. If the Senate took things away from you or gave you more, we're still interested in hearing what that was too.
Madam Chair, I would describe it as a work in progress and getting better all the time. In terms of clarity, in terms of the agency's input, so many of the ideas were ideas that needed to be raised with state agencies, Minnesota Housing Finance, for instance, Department of Employment and Economic Development also weighed in, and so on. So as it's gone through the Senate, I don't think we've lost any material, but we've improved upon the language. So if you'd like, I can go through.
Yeah, I would, and I just want to comment, though. I mean, you know, it is just, you know, it's very frustrating for the House to have this bill introduced on May 4th. It's pretty late. So with 11 days till adjournment to just finally being able to get a hearing, pretty late to the game here.
We understand that. We appreciate it very much. And as the coalition started, and we knew the hard work that the legislature in the House and the Senate had to go through with the deal with the deficit, and deal with other necessary actions of government, we saw that there was really no real focus on what we thought, just looking for jobs. So as a citizen of proof, we tried to, and that's why it's late. We have apologized profusely to the Senate, and we appreciate your recognition. It is late, and your willingness to hear it and learn about it.
And I do know other chairs are going to hear this bill as well, so I encourage you to get working with them. So please, if you can, and as we get the more updated information, we'll keep going. And members, we do have to hear it. I mean, honestly, something this late, this complicated, which is actually kind of like, you know, 10 member tax bills in here, you know, I wouldn't have considered it if it weren't for the fact that the Senate is going to bring it into the conference committee. So it's only fair that the House Tax Committee understand what the Senate is intending to do, I believe, tomorrow. So please, Mr. Griffiths.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The first provision relates to, actually this is one section that is not in the Senate bill, where it says stimulus project loans authorizing the State Board of Investment to make investments and loans for the Loan Guarantee Program. That is something that actually did not pass through the Senate, so you can knock that one out. In its place, however, is a provision that relates to minority and women contracting firms being included in any stimulus projects. So it just essentially restates what's in current law in Section 16C, protecting women and minority contractors. The next section, which is in the first engrossment, Section 2 relates to the Loan Guarantee Fund, which I described briefly. Again, the idea would be the state would appropriate up to $100 million into the Loan Guarantee Fund. In a perfect world, the fund would remain $100 billion. In other words, that the projects that would be received the credit enhancement would go through underwriting to ensure that they're good projects. Now, obviously, defaults can occur, and then there would be some call on the in addition, the members of the coalition would like to use the state investment as a way to attract the investment of some of the large banks, maybe some of the foundations, perhaps the union pension funds. And so the model that was used in the late 70s and early 80s was to attract others into the pool. And so, but you obviously need someone to dive into the pool first before you go around and attract others. So potentially the pool could be $100 million or it could be $300 million or $500 million as the Family Housing Fund grew. Are there questions about the loan guarantee concept?
Well, and I think we're going to have questions on all of this, but I noticed you, I think you have a lot of testifiers. Are there folks who want to testify for or against this bill here? No? Anybody? Maybe not. You're just here. Okay. Yeah, it's good if we can walk through it, hear from the public, and then I think we'll probably have a number of questions on a lot of different items. Because this is all new to us. So, please, Mr. Hart.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, a couple items of note in the loan guarantee fund. The loan guarantee fund is projects are eligible if they have a private loan commitment of $5 million or more to pay the cost of construction, and no loan guarantee may be more than $50 million. Of the $5 million of projects that we described, many of them are in the small range of $5 to $10 to $15 million projects, and so the idea is to incent as many projects as possible using the loan guarantee fund. The next section, Section 3 in the first engrossment, is the provision for bonds for qualified green building and sustainable design projects. And this is the provision that's had the most change between the first and second engrossment. So let me describe that change. Instead of creating a new bonding program through the Department through DEED, it was Senate Council believed it made more sense to use the existing industrial development bond provisions, since that provides clear authority for local units to issue industrial development bonds for qualified projects. And so the language that you'll see in the second engrossment then simply defines the type of green building and sustainable building project that might be eligible for industrial development bond financing, essentially conduit financing, since the private markets are not working like they should. And so instead of going to a bank, a sustainable or green project to approach a local unit of government, an economic development authority perhaps, and seek industrial development bonds for that qualified project. The next section is a state historic tax credit. We're one of a handful of states that have not yet adopted a state historic tax credit. I think there are 30 states that have adopted this type of credit. It would follow the federal credit and would enhance the ability of historic structures to receive investment from private financing. One of the things that's been noted in other testimony in the Senate is that historic projects by their nature are more labor-intensive than typical construction projects because of all the special work that has to go on with those projects. So that's Section 4.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt you, Mr. Grupples. We now are receiving a summary, and it's not lining up with what you're saying either. Because Section 4 is the low-income housing credit, and Section 3 was the historic credit, and the green bonding stuff was Section 6.
Madam Chair, I was working from the first engrossment since now.
Okay.
The first engrossment.
Okay, I see. Okay.
So I can get the second
either way.
In front of me, if you like.
Because I was reading off the health summary, so we have three different ways to go here. So I think we'll just keep going, and we'll keep finding it as you mention it.
All right. So
the way you're going is fine.
Okay, working through the first engrossment, that so Section 4 is the credit for historic structure rehabilitation. That actually takes a couple of pages until we get to Phase 8. And that's Section 5. And that's the low-income housing credit, tax credit again. It is a state tax credit that would mirror the federal credit. I understand there's been a fair amount of discussion with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. I was not the draft of these provisions, so I will probably fall short on any questions regarding these provisions. But I do know that MHFA has weighed in, and I believe there have been changes between the first and second engrossment to this low-income housing tax credit. The next section then in the first engrossment. Would be found on page 11, section 6. This section would authorize the use of special assessment financing for qualified energy conservation improvements. Recently, within the last couple of years, there was an extension of special assessment financing to the construction of skyways. This takes it a little bit further and allows private property owners or economic development authorities to seek special assessment financing in lieu of private financing. The idea is that if you're going to put in energy conservation improvements, you know, it, with the approval of a local unit of government, you might also obtain special assessment financing to do that. The next section is section 8, and that is also relating to the use of special assessment financing for energy conservation improvements. The first section, section 7, deals with an economic development authority, or HRA, seeking that financing. And the second section, I believe, is the petition by owners. A property owner could make that same request. The next section is section 9, and that relates to the petition by all owners, I'm sorry. So these three sections together provide special assessment financing for qualified energy conservation improvements. The next section is section 10. It's an idea that has worked in several states. It's taking the $8,000 federal tax credit for first-time home buyers and essentially monetizing it or creating a loan so you can actually use it in the present time frame for your down payment. So you would get a loan through the Housing Finance Agency or a designee, and you would then be able to take that loan, use it as a down payment on a new home, and then when you get your federal credit, you pay back the loan. So it's just moving the dollars forward by a year, so they're actually spurring home buying for first-time home buyers. And this also has received a fair amount of work through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency over the last several weeks. The next section, section 11, deals with tax increments. It allows the use of excess increments to pay for a stimulus project. The stimulus project is defined at the end of the bill as one that begins before December 31, 2012, and basically adds jobs, both permanent and construction jobs. The idea with many of these provisions, as you review the bill, is that they would sunset all but a handful of the provisions. I believe the tax credit provisions would continue, but all the rest of the provisions would sunset in a 2 to 3 year time frame, assuming that they're no longer necessary to stimulate construction. And then finally, also for an economic stimulus project, there would be the opportunity for local units of government to extend existing TIF districts which contain a stimulus project for a period of 10 years. And then, the last section of the bill, it was moved from the front of the bill to the back of the bill, is this one-year extension on building permits and development permits for projects that have already been approved. So that's a quick summary, Madam Chair and members, and Mr. Anfang is reminding me that $100 million has been appropriated for the loan guarantee bill on the Senate side.
Okay. Did anyone want to testify for or against this bill? Anybody can just take public testimony and go to questions. No one? Okay. Oh, sir? Come on up. We'll bring Mr. Griffith back up after all the testimony because there's a lot going on in this bill.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Dave Simran. I'm the Chief Executive for the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We represent builders and heavy constructors that are involved in commercial construction and roads and bridge construction as well. Just a few points that were not covered earlier. Minnesota's vertical construction industry has really been shut down because of the credit freeze or because of the general economy. In terms of job loss, we've lost a significant number of jobs, and what we'd like to do through this bill is create some opportunities for builders to go back to work. That's the whole purpose of this bill. It's not project specific. It's not union or non-union specific. It's a program that we hope where we could set the table for you to take some action to put people to work. Minnesota is proud of our relationship with we're proud of our relationship with our workforce, and what we're afraid of is if we don't put these people to work, we're going to lose them. We're not only in danger of losing good, trained, skilled workers, but we're in danger of losing many contractors as well. We've lost about 18,700 jobs in the construction industry for the 12-month period ending February of this year. That's about 16% and is 10th in the nation in terms of construction job loss. Compared to other states who are our neighbors, Wisconsin is 26th in job loss and Iowa is 45th in job loss. So we're not doing a very good job of keeping pace in terms of construction employment with our neighbors. And as was mentioned earlier by Mr. Amping, and the construction stimulus bill does very little, if anything, to affect the building sector. Most of these firms, most of the 16,000 construction firms in Minnesota, about 70% of them are building contractors that employ less than 25 workers. And so the stimulus bill is really only affecting about 30% of the construction industry. So we're missing a real opportunity here by not taking advantage of tools that might be available to us to put people back to work. Now we know this is not perfect legislation, and we again apologize for the lateness in getting this to you, but you have to keep in mind that we had a very large, diverse group of businesses and others that participated in this coalition. So we thank you for hearing this today, and we urge your support of it.
Thank you. Further public testimony. Please, welcome. Okay. However, there's some people wanted to ask the last two people questions too, and I had. Okay, sure. That's quick. What is it?
I just wanted to. You said the $30 affected 30% of the construction industry. I missed the part right from the top.
30% of the firms that will of Minnesota's construction firms will be impacted by the stimulus, the federal stimulus bill. 70% will not be.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Pete Carson with the Sheet Metal Workers Union. Over the past year, the Sheet Metal Workers Union has seen a decrease in membership due to lack of jobs. In addition, we currently have the highest unemployment rate in my 30 years in the industry. In 2004, there were 2,093 active working commercial members in the metropolitan area. Well, currently, there are only 1,686, that is a difference of 407 members, or a 20% decrease in active workforce in 5 years. Roughly half of those 407 members have retired, the other half have just left the union. In 2004, there were 552 active working residential members. Their numbers have decreased by 56% in the last 5 years to a membership of 245. Few of any of these decreases are from retirement. Commercial workers have 573 out of work, representing an unemployment rate of 34%. Residential workers have a 42% unemployment rate with 104 members out of work. Our production workers have gone from 835 members in 2004 to 544 members now, that is a drop in membership of 37%. Seven of our 38 residential shops are delinquent on their benefit payments for their employees. Approximately 6 to 8 of those 37 residential shops are reporting 0 hours in the past 3 months. The majority of our members are lucky enough to be employed are only working 3 or 4 days a week. Most of those members are therefore coming up short on their health insurance payments, having to supplement the cost either out of their dollar bank or directly out of their own pocket. This also reduces their contributions to the retirement account. I don't have hard numbers to give you on outstate Minnesota because they're combined with the remainder of the local, which includes North and South Dakota, which has been experiencing 100% unemployment and even over time. However, I can tell you that most of the outstate Minnesota is seeking the same conditions, but some areas are actually having a higher unemployment rate than the metropolitan area. Not only do these figures, personal hardship for those members, it also represents a loss in tax revenue and expenses. By passing census now, we have an opportunity to affect a positive position. I think just a follow-up. Last year at this time, I also testified in front of this committee about another jobs bill. At the time, we were at 16% unemployment. As you can see now, we're well over 32 or 40%. If this rate keeps on continuing for the next year, I'm really sad to say what's going to become of our year. There'll be many people left.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Appreciate it. Welcome.
Chairman Chesky and community members, my name is Todd Fowler. I'm the legislative director for the Laborers District Council of Minnesota and North Dakota. We represent over 11,000 career and special craft laborers within the state of Minnesota, of which greater than 30% are currently on the bench. Many of these members are in jeopardy of losing their health care benefits for themselves and their family members if they do not return to work very soon. Many of our members who are still working are working a reduced number of hours. For example, statewide, special craft laborers generally have worked an average of 1 million hours a month collectively. Alarmingly, last quarter, we were down to over 60% to an average of only 400,000 hours a month collectively worked. If this trend continues, we will have irrevocable consequences on all of our members' pensions and the affordability of their health insurance. What is before you represents the best efforts of a broad coalition of industry and economic development professionals designed to get projects and the construction economy moving. Over 11,000 skilled construction craft laborers are looking to do an active initiative to help jumpstart the $2 to $5 billion solid construction projects in Minnesota. I just wanted to take this opportunity in advance to thank you for your serious consideration of these innovative proposals.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan McConnell. I'm the political director for IBW Local 292, which represents Minneapolis and Western Minnesota. I just want to echo what he said. This isn't about a project. We've come back here several years in a row looking for help to get the construction industry more improving. We feel like we were the first ones to feel the effects of the economic downturn, and we feel that we are the key to turning our economy around. The key to solving our budget problems is to create economic activity, and we believe that this bill that goes a long way towards creating the economic activity that's needed.
Thank you, Mr. McConnell. Thank you for being here. Further public testimony for or against any provision in this bill? Please come forward. Yes. There's two chairs. So grab them. Please. Welcome.
Madam Chair, I hope it's not like United Airlines where you have to pay for both chairs.
Nobody pays for anything here. Public hearing.
My name is John Herman. I'm a partner in the real estate group at Fager & Denson. I have a practice that is largely representation of major development and redevelopment projects in the Twin Cities. I've worked closely with the coalition from the beginning, partly because I also represent two groups, the Design Build Institute of America, which is the part of the construction industry that is heavily involved with architecture and engineering as an integrated process with construction, and the American Institute of Architects, which is a trade association for architects. So I've worked on not only the advocacy of it for the bill, but also for the drafting of some of the parts of the bill. And I hope I can respond to both some specifics and give a little background. In my own practice, I can tell you that I have seen an almost complete cessation of housing development projects in the last 12 to 18 months, and obviously particularly since the fall of last year. We can't even make in our group, and we probably do 75% of the low-income housing projects in the state, we can't even make most of those projects work economically because of the difficulty of the sale of the housing tax credits for the kind of dollars that they were worth previously. We've seen dozens of projects in my own personal practice and the practice of my partners that have been laid over. Even places as stable as Bagri and Benson have actually experienced layoffs. But I would hardly come here and ask for help if it were a law firm problem. I think what we have here in the construction industry is a systemic and very unique problem associated with this sector and the lending meltdown that's happened in the country over the period since last fall. Many of the architecture firms that are members of AIA have already laid off 40 to 50% of the people who work in these firms. I know of other firms, a 60-person firm in St. Paul, a 13-person firm in St. Paul, which have basically gone out of business. Some of the DBIA members, Opus has been publicized in the paper, 60% layoffs in their A&E department. What does this mean about construction? When the trades and labor folks come up here and they say, today we've got 30% on the bench, if I'm telling you that in the architecture profession, 60% in many firms, some firms are higher than that, are not working, what it means is that for the rest of this year and possibly the spring of next year, there are no projects being designed. There are no projects that are actively moving forward in the development community. So I think we believe, I was in a meeting with the head of design and development for Target Corporation within the last month. He said he believes that there'll be a 75% decline in construction employment in Minnesota across the board, evidenced by the end of this year. I believe that too. Now, I don't have any projects I can make happen, even in areas where we have very strong continued demand, like rental housing, medical facilities, etc. So this vertical construction sector is a unique problem. I think that it probably accounts for a third of the current unemployment rate in the state, and it could be half of the unemployment rate. By contrast, this sector has been about 10% of the economy of the state historically, and we are one of the, we usually say, the sixth or seventh largest construction market in the country. In other words, Minnesota way outsized for construction in terms of exports out of the state. We have some of the largest construction firms in America, Opus, Ryan, Mortenson, that work nationwide, have affiliates throughout the country. We have some of the largest architecture firms. For many years, Ellerbe Beckett has been either the largest or the second largest architectural firm in the whole country, headquartered here. HGA, one of the largest firms, is headquartered here. Our architecture school at the university is one of the top 10 in the country. If we take this industry and we dismantle it, because it can't continue to operate in an environment where its overhead is so high compared to the amount of work that it's doing, and other markets are actually healthier than ours, and so their firms are experiencing less problems. It's a, I think, a long-term economic severe disadvantage for our economy in terms of export. So let me talk a little bit about the bill. It, as many people have said, this was a kind of an unusual coalition. I first got involved because a member of the AIA Council of Firms and also the Design Build Institute Board called me and said, we just did a little survey, and firms are not talking about where they're at this minute, but looking ahead where they're going to be in 6 months or 9 months, we're talking about 60%+ decline. We get a little group together and we'll talk about it. So I pulled 15 or 20 people together, and we had a series of meetings in our offices, brought in Dan McElroy. Actually, Dick Amfang came to one of the early meetings, and we said, wow, it's a pretty big problem. What could we do about it? It's a terrible budget year. We have really significant other needs. Obviously, we're all aware of that. So we said, you know, one of the things about real estate that's unusual is leverage. If you can just put in the last little bit to make something happen, then you have a much larger private investment. Vertical construction is all private. Roads and bridges, you guys have to pay 100 cents on the dollar. Academic buildings, probably you're paying 75 cents on the dollar, and maybe they fundraise 25%. In the real estate sector, if you put in a little bit, or you help the loan be a little bit bigger, you can generate 90% leverage from other sources, and certainly you can get much enhanced private investment compared to the public cost. I know that nobody does dynamic scoring in the budget area, but if you think dynamically about a sector that's in real depression, and you get some of these people back to work, and they generate $6 to $8 or $10 of private investment for every public dollar, I think the state actually dynamically will do better than it would do otherwise. So we came up with a whole series of ideas that are embodied in the bill that either have very low fiscal impact or in many cases have no fiscal impact this year, but help to try to keep projects alive and make things happen. So let me take a minute, if I can indulge the committee, and talk about a few of them. One that costs nothing is building permit extensions. Some cities have done this, but it hasn't happened across the board. If you had a project that you proposed in 2007, it's not underway, and you lose your building permit, you're starting over with your entitlements. It makes borrowing impossible, and it costs a fair amount of money to go through that process again. So what we say is, across the board, let's extend these permits uniquely for 1-2 time period. We have a lot of people who talk about doing energy investments, and last 2 years ago, I believe, so. 2 years ago, you guys allowed certain projects to be Chapter 429 specially assessed in water quality improvements. I've had clients use this already. What we propose is to allow that to be used for energy improvements. It would cost nothing. They're paid back by specials on the property. And we suggest two kinds of tax credits, low-income housing, to try to leverage the federal credit and increase the interest of Minnesota companies in being part of the credit buying pool. We've worked pretty hard on that language in the Senate with the Housing Finance Agency. Mirrored the statute in Massachusetts. 12 states, I believe, have this now, and we think it could be a significant benefit in closing the gaps on probably 30 to 40 low-income projects, some with credits going back to 2007 that are sitting waiting to move through the pipeline at MIFA but have gaps. Historic tax credits to try to encourage a few unique projects in that area. I know the committee's looked at that before. And this loan guarantee, I have a project that is happening that let me tell you about. I have a client called OATI. These names, of course, mean nothing anymore. It's the nation's largest software provider and data center for management of the smart grid. Believe it or not, it's located here. It's an incredibly profitable company. It manages at the present time 95% of electric transmission in North America. We're looking at buying a building, renovating it for $22 million into a new data center. This company, which has more than $10 million of liquidity in the bank, went to their normal bank, their relationship bank, and said, will you lend us the money to do this real estate project? The bank said, of course we'll lend to you, but it's real estate. And where we're at today in real estate, it doesn't matter who it is or where it is, it's 50 to 60% loan-to-value ratio. They said, are you kidding? It's a $22 million project. It would take all of our liquidity to do that project. And because Minneapolis has a guaranteed loan fund built up with a series of projects called the Common Project Fund, we were able to take that same project to them, underwritten by their financial advisors, and they've agreed to do an 80% loan-to-value ratio. And, of course, made the project feasible. It is going ahead to actually resolve their contingency on the land a few days ago and go forward. It's over 400 jobs with prospects of growing by several hundred in the next 2 years. But without the ability to go to that 80% loan-to-value ratio, I don't think that project would have happened. And who knows what the company would have done. Maybe they would have stayed put for a while. It just demonstrates the power of being able to leverage a little bit more and be able to make the deal happen. So that was our approach with the bill. I hope the committee, in spite of the late deadline, will give it serious thought and consideration. The loan fund part of it, I think, would be dramatically helpful to encouraging private investment in the state, and I think really entails no risk, because I would expect the underwriting to be stringent and the state to only work on projects that have a good track record. And of course, we're only talking about 80% loan to value in any of them. So I think the bill has a lot of merit and could make a lot of things happen for a comparatively small cost.
Thank you
very much.
Welcome. My name is Chip Halbach. I'm with the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and I appreciate the chance to get back together with my friend John, in that I do want to raise some issues before the committee on the low-income housing tax credit component of this bill. Before I get into that, I'll just say very briefly that I totally concur with what John and others have said about what's happening in the construction industry and more particularly with the affordable housing development, where projects across the state are being held up for the lack of investment dollars. I think it's very important for the state to address that and to figure out ways to put construction workers back to work, and also to ensure that low-income people who are now increasingly doubled up have places to live. And also we're doing a lot of work in southwestern Minnesota, where there's actually an economic boom, and they need workforce housing in order to keep up with the expanding job base down there. So there are many reasons for the state to invest in housing, for construction jobs and for decent places for people to live. We've worked in about 300 communities across the state over our history. I do want to encourage John to address the committee, but on the low-income housing tax credit component of the bill, which I believe is Section 7, in that we have done a lot of work over the years on what are the best state mechanisms for states to use the tax code to invest in affordable housing. And we've looked at a number of states that do low-income housing tax credit programs and other programs such as donor tax credits, which we believe is a preferred way to go. With the low-income housing tax credit program, the federal version is that the federal government on a per capita basis awards tax credits to the state running through our state housing agency. Then the state housing agency in turn allocates those to developers of affordable housing. the developers of affordable housing actually have to then sell those tax credits to investors to raise the cash to put into the housing. And through this mechanism, they're able to get about half of the cost of creating affordable housing. That's prior to the collapse of the market John just referred to, where investors have been pulling out of the tax credit market and it's going down. But in the best of times, the investors would be paying about 90 cents for each of those federal tax credit dollars. And so there is a discounting that goes on. And but what we have when a state replicates this type of approach is that there is an inherent penalty that goes on for the investors because state taxes are deducted on your federal income tax. So people who invest in state tax credit programs pay a lot less than they invest in federal housing tax credit programs. Low-income housing tax credits. For our research that we looked at in 2004, we found that across the spectrum that California, which was a high end of what people were investing, there people would invest 62 cents for a dollar of tax credit. So you would get into a project a little less than that, about 60 cents for each dollar that the state would forego in taxes through a tax credit program. But California did very well because California has a huge economy, and there are thousands of corporations in California, some of which were investing in the tax credit program. When you look at the other end of the spectrum, Missouri, this was the standard there, people were investing about 30 cents for a dollar that the state was foregoing for the tax credit. So as we looked at the research, we said that's a horrible investment for state government, that you get 30 cents into your project for each dollar that you give up in taxes. So we came up with different mechanisms that I could go in and the committee would look at, but I think it's important, it's too important, and dollars are too scarce without having good discussion on what are the best ways for the state to invest dollars into something that's very much needed, which is the construction of affordable housing. I prefer the state direct investment of appropriations through the challenge program, which we also have studied in there. It shows that leverages the 6-7 additional dollars, and something like 70% comes back to the state in taxes for each of the dollars invested. But I realize this is the tax committee. There are other ways, like a donor tax credit for putting funds out there that a variety of other states have used. But I think we're dealing with a piece of legislation that's moving fast as it's coming to the end of the legislation. But we do need to at least consider whether this is a decent option for the state's investment in something that's very much needed.
Thank you. Further public testimony. I want to get through all the public testimony first. Anyone else?
Madam Chair, could I respond for a second to the questions about how the tax credit works?
Well, it wasn't a question from committee members, though. So maybe you two can just have a, we have a list of committee members who will have questions, and I want to first get through the public testimony. So if we could do that, we'll probably have you back up because people may have questions on all the parts of the bill. So
thank you very much.
Thank you. Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bonnie McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, the statewide nonprofit organization that helps to empower communities to preserve their historic buildings. And I'm pleased to say that the Preservation Alliance is part of the coalition as part of this bill, and I'm here to speak I'm in favor of it and to urge you to pass it forward to the floor if possible. The Historic Preservation Tax Credit is included in this bill. It's a 25% rehabilitation tax credit to help catalyze reinvestment in our existing resources in communities large and small. You may have seen this provision before. It has been at the legislature for several years. We thank Representative Marquardt for sponsoring it this year as well. I'm here to answer questions about the credits, but in brief, it mirrors a federal tax credit that is a 20% rehabilitation tax credit, and more importantly, this provision exists in 30 other states across the country, so Minnesota is missing out on the investment that could be coming into the communities across the state. We hope that you will support this provision because it would provide important investment to also leverage federal investment. Minnesota is right now 22nd in the nation in using the federal historic tax credit because we do not have a state version of this credit. Therefore, our investment is moving to the states surrounding us because we can't leverage that additional investment.
Anybody who's got a question on historic credit or anything else, we can have people come back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We just want to make sure everybody who's been waiting today gets a chance to testify. Thank
you, Madam Chair. I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency, and I'll be very brief. I want to say a couple of things. The federal low-income housing tax credit is the economic engine for the development of affordable rental housing across the nation. Unfortunately, in the last few years, the price of tax credits has dropped dramatically, which has meant that we're left with a large gap to try and get these projects going. We have a number of projects that are stalled. The federal stimulus package will help enormously, at least for the 08 and 09 credits. Going forward, if tax credit prices don't go up, we'll still be in the problem of having a big gap. Having said that, Mr. Herman and I have had a number of conversations about the inefficiencies of the tax credit program. In our opinion, we think it's unlikely that we will get more than about 30 cents on the dollar. So I was asked a question this morning in Senate taxes about present value. At that time, I was unprepared to answer, but I can answer it now. If the state were going to spend $10 million in tax credits over a 10-year period, it would need to have the equivalent of $7.7 million now to invest in order to have the $10 million over the 10 years. If we get 30 cents on the dollar, we will only be getting $3 million in investment in affordable housing. I can promise you that every dollar that's appropriated to the Housing Finance Agency gets spent on programs. So there's a clear difference in my mind between a tax credit program and an appropriation to the state agency for the same purposes. So I just want to, we have a difference of opinion about how much we're going to get. Even if we got Mr. Herman's estimate of 60 cents on the dollar, the state would still be committing more money than it would be getting back in terms of investment. In terms of cash, it would go into the housing. Now, that's a pretty simplistic view. Obviously, you're going to generate income taxes for the workers and all of those things, but just looking at sort of the, you know, the size of the program, that's our perspective on it.
Thank you, Ms. Barr. Further public testimony. Anybody else want to speak for or against the bill? Okay, so we're through that. Okay, so we're going to start with questions. Representative Downs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not quite sure who to direct the questions to. I have a few, so cut me off if you want to refer to other members. But I guess bills that come fast at the end of, especially presented by lobbyists, automatically raise a couple questions for me. And ones that ask the state to do what private industry isn't willing to do, maybe makes me doubly nervous. So I'd like to peel back the onion on this a little bit. From the State Board of Investment perspective, do you have a sense for what the return on investment on these loans are going to be? Does this kind of fit in, and is it commensurate? Is that return commensurate with what we'd be getting from the SBI in general?
Who would like to answer that? Oh, yes. I think that was dropped in the bill.
Yes, that's all I was
going to
say. Oh, thank you.
That was the first one we were working on. And members, we now have the new Senate language, I guess,
passed and passed on 250. Well, they changed it again since then, but this is more current. So, Representative Downey, next question. But the loan guarantee fund is still there.
Yeah,
that's so just the State Board of Investment, as I understand that provision was allowing them originally to do it, but the loan guarantee issue remains the same, the fund that they're creating up to $100 million.
Yeah, so maybe the question, if I couldn't add, Chair, what will be the return on that fund?
Mr. Griffith?
Madam Chair, members, we are still working through details. The three sources for the fund would be the investment areas that we did in fund building, the insurance premiums that the fund could charge, or the fees that the insurance developers to get into the fund. And then there's also a capture, a proposed capture of the sales tax on construction equipment and materials. It could also go into the fund. And so all of those sources would create some stability in the fund and create earnings. I don't know what at what rate. The idea that we would be able to attract private lenders in the fund, that we have to get a better return in that fund than, say, other investments, since there might be some risk of default.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, with other real estate investment funds, there's different class shares and different rates of return. So the state in this particular case is not taking any kind of an equity share position. It's simply a loan guarantee with a kind of a straight up return, and the other investors would be getting the higher rates of return. Okay.
Well, Representative, I don't think the state gets a return. It's a loan to the private developers. We don't get a cut back of that.
So it's a 0%? Is it a loan guarantee or is it a loan?
A loan guarantee.
Okay, thank you. All right, so the loan
it's
provision.
It's a loan guarantee. The state puts no money into the loan. The loan is actually made by the financial institution. The state agrees to provide a guarantee and is paid a fee for the guarantee.
Okay. Well, Representative Downey, I think the state does put money into it once it's running.
I could be confused on the first and growth versus the second.
Okay, so for committee members of the tax committee, understand that when you let someone keep their own sales tax, that is the state putting in money. So that is a cost to the state. So I think unless this is not familiar language, the sales tax that would be done on material and construction, they're proposing that they would not pay that tax. And would instead capture that money that would therefore go to the state to use in this loan guarantee. So there's a state cost.
Yeah.
Unless that's wrong, please correct me.
Madam Chair, the model for this fund was the example that I described, the Minneapolis Common Project Fund. Minneapolis originally provided a guarantee of small issue IDBs and backed that guarantee with a letter of credit that they acquired from one of the state's A-rated banks. And they charged a fee for acquiring the letter of credit and backing the loans. The state doesn't, and so in this example, the state would not actually lend money. The $100 million funds an initial guarantee fund that is available in the event that there's a call on the guarantee. The sales tax proceeds go into that fund, and we hope to raise money from, additionally, some lending institutions as backing that fund by putting in deposits or putting in a letter of credit type backup. The concept is that you don't have to have 100 cents to back 100 cents of guarantees. We have 20 cents available to back those guarantees. We would charge a 3% fee to access the fund. And the concept is not that we will lose money. The concept is to encourage banks to get back to the level of lending that they provided before on strongly creditworthy projects that make sense. So in the perfect world, there would be no losses and a small amount made on the fees. In an imperfect world, there might be some losses, but we would hope that they would be small enough to be offset by the 3% fee and the additional amounts from these stimulated projects that would come into the fund.
Representative Downey, page 2 in the bottom, that's the part I'm talking about.
and I guess we're both kind of right here, if I'm reading this correctly, if, you know, in a perfect world, yes, nobody fails, but people will fail. And if there wasn't risk here, then they wouldn't be coming to the government and asking for assistance. So
yeah,
the banks and the creditors aren't willing to do this, but, you know, I'm not, I'll just be honest, and I think folks here know this, I'm not a fan of this stuff, because if the lenders and the capitalists and the folks who know how to do this aren't willing to free up credit right now, I don't believe it's government's role to do that. But when you back, when you use the full faith and credit of the state to back something, you have to have it paid off if it doesn't work. So you have the sales and use tax in here, of course. We have, there's another number of other things in here, so it's sort of semantics. I know it's on the last page, there's $100 million appropriation.
Thank
so the state's in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might, if there are other questions, I can certainly defer.
No, please, because I think everybody needs to understand the full loan guarantee. That's a big part of the bill.
You mentioned the projects were unspecified. I'm curious if you can give us any sense of the number of projects, their average size. Is there one or two really big ones and a bunch of small ones?
Madam Chair, members, I think
sure.
Dave Semrad of the ABC is familiar with the number of kinds of projects I have.
Mr. Semrad? Please.
Madam Chair, members, so we have given a list of projects to Representative Sertich, and it is a confidential list because there's proprietary information in that. Many of these projects are in negotiations presently, and the contractors that are involved and the owners that are involved in the project do not want the information made public.
So maybe since you can't give out proprietary information, you could give Representative Downey some descriptors.
Overall numbers.
Representative Downey and members, the projects range from anywhere from $100 million projects all the way down to $2 or $3 million projects. It's a wide range. There are many of them. Most of them are located in the 11-county metro area. Some are located in outstate Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know there's a bunch of projects, outstanding bonding projects, about $1.2 billion worth of approved projects, I think, from prior to bonding. Were those looked at as possible sources to either augment or perhaps replace the need for this fund?
Representative Downey, members, most of the projects that are on the list are private projects, and so the bond, not every job is on there that is shovel ready. We tried to put together a representative list of projects to give some credibility to the projects that are on hold. So I don't have the list in front of me right now, so I can't identify all the projects and whether some of those bonding projects are on there.
And Donnie?
Just one final question. My sense is that on the residential real estate market, it's been way overbuilt and overvalued literally for decades, in large part because of government incentives that have driven it that way. And I know the commercial real estate market goes on a 5 to 8 year cycle all on its own. And I'm curious if you could maybe offer your opinion as to why we would try and jump into that and perhaps try and force something into the market that just isn't sustainable and the values aren't there, and that we might even perpetuate the problems on the residential side, or try and do something counter-cyclical on the commercial real estate side that we just shouldn't be doing, period, let alone having the state fund it.
Representative Downey and members, there may be somebody here from the Builders Association, which really could speak to that a lot better than I can. Our association is mainly involved in commercial and heavy type work, so I don't know if Lisa Fernandez is here.
Did someone from the Builders want to respond? No. Okay, Mr. Anthony.
Madam Chair, if I could, I'll give a stab at it. The first of all, the loans will originate from a private institution. The money to build the project will come from a private bank. They will do the due diligence to make sure that the project fits in the economy, that the project can cash flow, the project is worthy of a loan from a private institution, and the money will come from there. And the state will not be funding the project. They will be guaranteeing a portion of the project. So the due diligence that the private industry is out there to make money, the banks are out there to make money, they'll continue to do their due diligence to ensure that the project will get repaid and get built.
Thank
you, Madam Chair, and then I will defer. Just one final comment. I think the premise here is that the banks won't do these deals. They're requiring ratios that are untenable for the business and equally untenable for them. So there is not a free market transaction that's viable absent government intervention here, whether it's with a loan guarantee or actual money. So I see us stepping in and trying to force what the free market just would not find to be a tenable deal. So I appreciate that we're not spending money, but it does still seem that we're trying to force things, and I'll defer to others for future questions.
There are more questions. Representative Downey, I think that, that's right. It's private funding, but it's not working without government backing. So if it fails, then yes, the government is on the hook. So, right, I think this, the whole guarantee loan concept here is for private developers. It's not for public projects. And, I'll just tell you, I think you and I, Representative Downey, would disagree on this. I think we're on the Capital Investment Committee, right? No, okay. I'll tell you, I said this in tax conference committee when we were talking about all these other business subsidies that were before us the other night. I think, and I'm in a minority, I think Representative Alston and Senator Lang said should have been given a significantly bigger target. And if we needed to put construction folks to work, we should be building a lot more than 200 to 300 million. We should have given them a billion. Instead of now coming up with a guarantee backed by the state for this private project to go forward, that banks won't give them credit. So, I know that's sort of controversial in this room on different positions, but it seems to me that if we need to get everyone in construction to work, we should just build more public projects that we were going to build anyhow. But that's, what government does and let the private folks do it the way they're going to do. So this is for private development. It is not for public development.
Madam Chair, just a quick response.
Mr. Griffith.
Thank you. To the question, Representative Downey, the bill contains very, very little for residential housing. The only residential housing piece is just taking that first-time home buyer tax credit, which is available to the federal government, and bringing it forward 1 year. So it monetizes that tax credit. It's a loan. It's $8,000, and it's specifically for first-time home buyers. The only other provisions are for low-income housing. The highest demand right now for housing is for low income and for seniors. And so it's a very narrow band of measures that affect residential, primarily multifamily. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out which microphone. Like Representative Downey, I'm focused on the loan guarantee things, and a couple of quick questions. I've been reviewing. I'm stuck on the first engrossment, so I apologize if there's information in the second engrossment. Representative Broad and I have been fighting over the one copy that we've been able to find here between us. And she won, yeah. So, mother tried to raise me a gentleman. I'm not seeing any criteria here for what projects, what developers would be eligible for this loan guarantee. And it seems like at that case we're buying blinds. We're backing people up, but we're never doing kind of the background. Thank you. Very good. The background, the underwriting to assure ourselves that the risk the state is taking on
is limited. Is there criteria in the second engrossment that I'm not seeing in the first?
Mr. Griffin.
Madam Chair, there is actually an expansion of the guarantee criteria between the first and second engrossment. And I'm just reading through it very quickly, but the commissioner of deeds is distributing projects throughout the state. There should be information requiring the applicant to provide the number of jobs and wages, the ability of the borrower, this is new, the ability of the borrower to repay the loan is a primary consideration in deciding to issue the guarantee. A comprehensive source of standard financial ratios and financial statistics must be compared to companies in the same industry. Other criteria including financial statements, management capability, collateral, and the bank's normal underwriting standards are referenced. So there has been an attempt to address the question that you raised. There may be other things that could be added to make that criteria stronger, but that's been the direction over the last several days.
Right,
line 2.13.
2.13, thank you.
And what I think it's, I mean, well, you can, whatever you think, Representative. I mean, I personally have never seen anything this limited myself either. I mean, even Job B has job counts at certain prices and all kinds of things. This is pretty loose. I think it's lines 213 to 226.
Moving on, but staying on the same issue, Madam Chair, if I may, on risk to the public from this loan fund, I'm thinking of what type of projects, since we're not being told what type of projects would be built, what type might be built, and I'm wondering about, say, that I've never understood this, maybe somebody can explain it, the number of hotels that have been being built. It's amazing. I used to have in my palm for the city of Minneapolis the number of hotel rooms that were being built each and every year. And I don't understand the finance. I assume that there's some magic to financing hotels that makes the rest of the project work. I don't get it. But let's say it's a hotel project that's been extended a loan guarantee, and there's some issue of labor strike related to the project. Putting the private financing at risk. What can be done to ensure that hotel developers won't need to tap this fund in order to complete the project?
Is there anyone from the hospitality industry who want to respond to? Please, yeah.
Representative Dabney and members, one of the principles in our coalition was that we did not want to identify any type of project or location of project that this program would apply to. I understand your comment about the labor peace issue. That came up this morning in the Senate committee. And if we begin to address specific type projects, then actually we're going against one of the principles of our coalition, which was to stay neutral on those issues. We did not talk about any type of labor preference, union or non-union, or prevailing wages, because these are private projects. This was not designed to address public projects. So we really wanted to stay project neutral.
Or did anyone else want to respond? Hospitality industry speak for themselves? No? Okay. Yes, please, come to me.
Madam Chair, my memory is coming back to me. I have had it explained to me that the reason that every time you turned around somebody was building a hotel in Minneapolis was because there actually was need in the business community for more hotel beds. But I've also read recently that is no longer the case, that in fact we're overbuilt. So while it is a principle of your coalition not to pick and choose, perhaps as this goes forward, given that the hotel sector is overbuilt, perhaps, you know, the state, if it's going to stand behind these things, should pick and choose whether we guarantee loans for an overbuilt sector or not, instead of a prohibition on the use of that loan fund for hotels, for instance. But looking at the TIF provisions here, and staying on this hotel and labor issue, if TIF revenues from hotel projects are insufficient to cover a city's bonds, who makes up the project?
who makes up the difference, particularly given, I think we're all acknowledging that the hotel sector is overbuilt in the Twin Cities.
Well, I think
Representative Dabney, that may be a question for Bill Griffith or maybe John Herman.
Mr. Griffith? Is someone? And while someone's coming up, Representative Dabney, I should tell you because, you know, again, we didn't know about this. But in the PAC conference committee, and there was, I think he walked out. There's not a name, but I think he left on, you know, I don't think he's here for this bill, but there was a different tax subsidy, you know, another bunch of tax preferences being debated in the tax conference committee last night. And that, very specifically, the Senate added, and I don't even support that one either.
I'm sure.
But the Senate added on that one, and we could certainly do that. They put no retail. And so you could certainly do like no retail here, or no hotels, or no whatever. But the Senate was clearly delineated in this other tax credit proposal, which was more moderate than this one, that they wouldn't allow. So you're right, we can attempt to do that. So, please.
Madam Chair, addressing Representative Dabney's question directly, tax increment typically now is done on one of two bases. It's either done pay-bill, where the developer advances all of the tax increment expenditures, receives the taxes back over time as a payment on the, quote, pay-go note. And so in that circumstance, if there were insufficient revenues, the developer would bear the risk. The second kind of tax increment that's commonly done now is where after the project is completed and assessed, the tax increment notes are sold as revenue bonds, which are backed solely by the taxes. Typically, they're sold at a 1.2 to 1.25 to 1 coverage ratio. In other words, if you have a tax stream that would generate a dollar, you could sell 80 cents worth of tax increment bonds, revenue bonds. In that case, the risk is, split between the buyer of the bonds, which takes the risk that there's not enough extra coverage there to provide for payment of the bonds, even though they start out with 1.2 or 1.25 to 1 coverage, and the developer, who would typically hold a B note for the balance on a pay-go basis. So the developer would take the first-tier risk of insufficient tax increment, and then there would be a second risk to the private investor that holds the bonds. I don't think I've seen a city take a GO risk on tax increment in the last 10 or 15 years, to be honest, maybe even 20.
One last question, Madam Chair. I'm noticing on line 2.2, I've gotten to the second endorsement now, that for a project to be eligible, there has to be a private loan commitment of $5 million or more. And that's a lot of money until you if it were in my bank account, it would be an awful lot of money. But when you talk about the size of some of these projects, it seems like I don't see any language in here that talks about a proportion of the project being privately funded. $5 million isn't a lot for some of the projects I think you're talking about here. But it could be a very small amount of a project and the state being asked to be a guarantee to a loan that is much, much larger than anything that the private entity is putting forward to move their own project. Can I get educated on that as well, please?
You're looking for a percentage as opposed to $5 million.
Yes, that would be a thought. If it's a billion-dollar project, putting in $5 million isn't much of a commitment.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, the bill has two limitations. One limitation, I believe, is that the amount of the state guarantee can't exceed $25 million on any individual project. $50 million on any individual project and can't exceed 25% of the total amount of the loan.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time.
Further, a follow-up on that. So can you explain this to me? So let's say you're a huge project and you're looking for, I don't know, $300 million. You could still come and try to get 50 of that.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the concept was to allow that level of flexibility, but I have to tell you, frankly, my expectation is that that in the deed underwriting, they would be looking to have a large pool of projects with some diversity of type and geographic location, and that they would concentrate the projects in the areas where obviously we're not having marketplace difficulties. I think that the state obviously has a lot of experience in the Housing Finance Agency and underwriting housing projects, and I'd expect there'd be some sharing there of expertise and criteria. We have quite a bit of experience actually in economic development guarantees in funds like this Common Project Fund in Minneapolis, where the guarantee is 100% actually of the amount of the loan. And deed itself has a smaller couple of similar guaranteed funds with respect to small issue IGDs and agricultural processing projects.
Okay, I see Representative Downey's trying to take off, and we're going to go to Representative Gardner. But I do want to just mention something before you leave, Representative Downey. I'm glad Representative Lanning's here. He's been working on flood items with Representative Marquardt. And I don't see Representative Demmer, but Representative Reinert here. And for the public, Representative Lanning, Reinert, and I are the TIF working group for the House, and Representative Demmer's not here right now. But, you know, the TIF part that Representative Downey raised is really important, I think, to this committee. We've had a lot of discussions about TIF, and you know, I guess when people say there's no state fiscal impact, we all know that there's huge property tax increase impact, though, when we allow a TIF to be extended even a year. Much less this bill that on page 17, line 22, allows all the TIF districts to be extended 10 years. And I just want folks to know that this TIF working group heard some proposals who asked for a year or two or three or five, and we said no. And we've pretty much always said no in the House, and people know that. We added some new rules of flexibility that went into the tax bill, whether it was the knockdown rule, you know, some other things recognizing the economic climate. But, you know, I do want to ask Mr. Michael, I mean, this is how I think about, you know, this idea that we have extended TIF districts 10 years. I mean, members know what we've been through with Minneapolis and their NRB neighborhoods, and St. Paul wanted their extension, and we've all collectively said no for a lot less years than that. You know, South St. Paul had it this year and others, and so the TIF working group worked really hard on all these proposals, and had this bill been in, we would have reviewed that too. But I just want to be honest with the advocates here that I think that's really unlikely the House would ever support that. And I'd ask these members to chime in. I mean, but first I'd ask Mr. Michael, I'm just trying to think of, you know, we have like 2,100 TIF districts in the state, and these I see are limited to anything after the pre-79, so 1979, and up to 2013, which to me doesn't even seem like a stimulus project for the economy because you don't even have to get going until 2015. But and I think we'll be long out of recession by then. But, you know, it seems to me that if you did that, you know, in a statewide way, because most people will do it. They'll just do it. Like, great. Great extra 10 years. You're talking, you know, $500 million, $1 billion, maybe more than that, in property tax increases over the life of those extensions. Mr. Michael, am I not thinking about that right of what sort of a blanket 10-year extension? I think we're talking at least $1 billion of property tax increases. And it isn't a state fiscal impact, but we all know it's property tax increases. Mr. Michael?
I don't remember off the top of my head exactly how much the annual increment revenues are, but it's in around the magnitude of $250 million. So in theory, every district, and some of that is obviously 279 districts, so if you just say, well, let's say it's $200 million, and every district did it, you can get an idea. There is some state cost to this because the property tax refunds are higher. There's also an effect on the local government aid. It doesn't increase state costs, but it shifts it among cities because those values are assumed to not be available to to pay for local services, so it shifts from one city to another depending upon, you know, how much captured value you have.
And I don't want to take a whole bunch of this much time, but I mean, you should know how the tax may think about all this. And there is, and I haven't even thought about the local government age shift that would result as a result of this provision of extending TIF districts. There's also the fiscal disparity component that comes into play. I mean, I think if you take the 200 number, you're talking, like, you know, an easy billion to $2 billion property tax increase. And so I just want to be honest, but I think it's like the House folks would support this, but I want to ask Representative Lanning and Representative Reiner directly, who spent a lot of time on TIF, and, you know, kind of how they're just reacting to extending TIF districts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I share your concern with regard to this proposal. And if we were to do something like this after we said no to a lot of other communities in terms of their wanting to extend TIF, I think we would be having a double standard, which I think is unacceptable. So I share your concern.
Thank you, Representative Reiner.
You already hit, but probably the two most salient points. And the first one is that we walked through all of these individual projects and we came up with a couple of basic assumptions that we thought made sense, given the current economic circumstances. We dealt with knockdown Europe and dealt with extensions, but, you know, and I think you hit the other major point. We all, most of us, we come out of local government more well, that TIF districts may not show up in the state's ledger sheet, but they sure show up on the ledger sheet of local government.
Thank you. Further discussion on the TIF from members before we go on to more questions. Representative Mullery, please.
I guess I'm just not understanding. You said that it's half to a billion and it's 200 annual over 10 years. And I guess that's 200 annual.
Times 10 years. $2 billion. And they wouldn't, and I think not everybody would do it, we know that. And there are some 329s that still include the 329. There aren't very many of those left, though. So they're a very small piece. But, you know, for those of us who served on local government, and lots of us here have, if we all know, if we were on the mayor and the city council, what we might do with this kind of a provision. So we do have to, and in fact, this committee tracks property tax increases as a result of the bill. We have to pay for the increased property tax refunds as a result of any bills, and we have to deal with the LGA follow-up and fiscal disparities as well. So there's a lot of implications for the tax committee on that provision. Representative Wofford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, the other thing that I think it's true, particularly in the TIF world, where there's just, it's up to the governing body and the net value of the project is located to find that there's a net increase in jobs either created or retained, including construction jobs, and then with a lot of economic displacement, which is some of the problems that we've run into with Job Z, where a municipality to make a project successful will recruit, or the developer will recruit businesses from other areas, which then have a vacancy and job loss in their area. And there's no provisions in here for looking at it for net loss, and I think we should look at construction jobs and permanent jobs separately. As we're evaluating each of these, so we really know on both components, you know, how we're gained or not.
Okay, Representative Gardner, Newsland, unless people have further comments on the TIF before we left the TIF. Just trying to get an honest reaction here. I think that one's not too plausible on the health side, but Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as we're all trying to evaluate trade-offs to make during the session, I'm looking at the $100 million for a loan guarantee, and I would be interested if the advocates had any numbers on the number of jobs that would be leveraged as a result. And, you know, we're doing $100 million out of the budget. We're talking about teachers laid off and healthcare workers laid off, too. So, you know, we could make an honest assessment of the trade-offs. But for the advocates, I also had a question, too, about, you know, the projects. I know this is a proprietary list, but I guess I'm curious what percentage of the projects or what percentage of the private capital that would be leveraged as a total economic activity is going to go to, you know, what percent goes to low-income housing, what goes to sort of buildings, redesign, energy conservation versus other general run-of-the-mill commercial projects, or, you know, so just going to have 1 or 2% for all these things that I think are good, like historic rehabilitation, low-income housing, or is it going to be taken up by a big chunk of other types of private development.
And thanks, Brad. I didn't think of that, Representative Gardner. I assume the historic credit and the low-income credit and the affordable housing credit all were separate from the loan guarantee. Could the loan guarantee be applied to those purposes, historic credit? They're shaking their heads. No. Does somebody want to? I think it's all in the commercial area.
All the loans and resource credit as well as their public credit. Whether it's a credit or a guarantee or whatever.
So first, is the loan guarantee part of this bill, which is a lot of things in this bill, is that for the historic folks and the low-income folks and the first-time homebuyer folks, or is that just for the commercial folks, the loan guarantee part?
Well, it's certainly not for the average members of the community, certainly not for first-time homebuyers. I do think that it would theoretically be available for a low-income or a historic project, but my expectation would be that those projects would not need the additional lending if they had the credits, and consequently they'd be disinclined to pay the additional amount that it would cost to have that guarantee on top of the regularly available financing. My expectation is, and I would say I speak only from my own personal anecdotal knowledge of what's happening in the marketplace, is that the primary projects that would likely benefit from the loan guarantee would be rental housing, primarily market rate rental housing. I think the second area where there'd be considerable interest would be medical facilities. And the third area would be senior housing, which is having a very, very difficult time now because the 501c3 bonding market, which have been the principal source of financing for senior projects for entities like Presbyterian Homes and Walker and Ecumen, is basically moribund now. You cannot sell those bonds at all. I don't think that these problems in the credit market reflect on the problems of the projects in these distinct areas themselves. They reflect a more systemic problem with the lending market. And so motivating the market to work better by providing a partial guarantee, if the projects are properly underwritten and reviewed by deed, which I'd expect they would be, should generate development which makes sense, puts people back to work without displacement and without constructing things we don't need. Representative Dabney's not here right now. I represent several hotels in downtown, and yeah, I don't think we need to build another hotel in downtown Minneapolis, and I don't think that he would underwrite a loan of that type. But there are certainly markets which have more than ample demand. It's just they're not happening at all now.
Okay, and so did someone else want to answer the other part of the question that Representative Gardner had about, you know, what percentage of the pool thing, now not the loan guarantee, is really going to go to the green, the low income, the historic? I mean, it appears to me it's a very minor part of the total set of tools available. Is that where you're going with that, Representative Gardner?
No, I'm sure. I'm just curious as we make the case to the public for the decisions that we make, and if this bill would go through, I'd like to be able to say, well, this is going to, if this had not passed, we would see X number of people who would still be on the bench. There would be X percentage of structures that were not built or certain units of housing.
Madam Chair, I could take a stab at the jobs issue if that would be helpful.
I think he was thinking what percentage of what is available to. All the provisions. Were you asking about jobs? I think let's try it for how the people get their heads around here, quite honestly. Right. This is like 10 different taxes rolled into one. Okay, so the historic thing, we've heard that here over and over. We all understand how that works. Representative Marquardt's period, Representative Lanning, we all get how that works. That's a standalone bill unto its own, right? And I don't think any of these provisions help them at all. I think they're here for the historic part. And then we've got a couple of housing ones, and we've heard some testimony that we're not even sure the housing advocates are big fans of these proposals. But and you missed, Representative Dabney did, the last version of your bill on the Housing Finance Agency a couple days ago, and in fact, the committee pretty bipartisanly killed that thing off. Good. And then Patty created a new sort of tax credit with working with MHFA that was more acceptable, and that even on a roll call barely passed through this committee. So I'm just being honest, Representative Downey asked for that roll call, and we kind of reworked that provision already. So I think, you know, we're trying to get to the set those to the side, because we kind of understand all those, but we have all these other things going on. And I think the TIF one, to me, is sort of the biggest dollar amount that gives these money to people, but shows up on the revenue estimate as zero because it's not state. But, you know, do you want to try to answer Representative Gardner's holistic question here?
Madam Chair, I can give some jobs information that we've used all along per $1 billion of investment. And these numbers are based on a study performed earlier this year at George Mason University and also our chief economist in Washington, D.C. at Agency of America. But in Minnesota, an additional $1 billion would add $1 billion in investment would add about $2.4 billion to the state's gross domestic product and about $755 million to personal earnings. And create or sustain about 21,000 jobs, and that's per $1 billion of investment. The construction has been about 10% of GDP, and when you look at the vertical construction industry, representing about 70% of the industry, you've got 70% of a huge economic engine that's sitting on the sidelines. And so when we first started this coalition, we were mainly interested in putting people back to work.
Thank you. Further question, Garner? Yes? Please.
No.
No, perhaps on these ones.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I think I can talk about the bring something to the table, but I guess I'd like to go back to just kind of a more philosophical, fundamental question. You know, why aren't private lenders available to lend? These are good projects. They're good projects. And what if we know that a private lender doesn't know? I'm just baffled at how we can use a little gap financing here when we have all kinds of other gap financing pieces in place that are helping as well. Why would you take a little bit more to leverage a little bit more? I mean, if there's such a good project, why? What is keeping the private market away from this company?
Is there anybody here from the banking lending industry? I know there's all kinds of people for the bill, but they don't work in that area. So is there anybody who's a professional in that area who can answer that question? Nobody. Okay. You know, Representative Eastland, I think you're hitting at that, but that's what gives everyone pause. If they won't do it, then why should the government? Why should the taxpayers do it? But they're not here, so we do need to...
Well, one other question.
Sure, Representative Eastland.
And I guess I'm just looking at subdivision 2 here. I might do that too much. We're talking about the budget. $5 million or more, if we're going to go down the route like this, and someplace in here says that 40% of it has to be in all state or something like that, right? 40% of money or something has to be spent in all state. There's a lot of projects smaller than that in all state that could benefit from this. But I just question that number, if that's a good number. But then I'm looking at residential, commercial, industrial projects. Have we done any analysis of the surpluses of real estate out there in the commercial and industrial area? As I see it, there's empty buildings everywhere. And I guess, so we're going to push a market to build more real estate at a time where we have empty property everywhere. And I'm just struggling to understand how that in the big picture gets us down the road of... getting rid of the surplus, it seems to the point where the market will sustain itself.
Mr. Griffith, are folks in the development business? I know Mr. Griffith is, Mr. Herman, are you in the development business? I think that was a question for developers. Please.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm a real estate development and finance lawyer. Let me try to answer your question in a number of ways.
Our rural members always try to say, I'm just a farmer, and they always get what's going on.
Please. It's easy to be cynical about the marketplace at the moment. I'm one of those who's in the camp of believing that if the government hadn't stepped forward and agreed to back a huge exposure to us as a citizenry, the larger banks and underwriting houses in New York, all of them would have gone the same direction as Lehman because they made foolish and irresponsible decisions. But the fact is, we're a large and complicated economy, and those decisions got made because of bad regulation. And if we hadn't propped up the institutions, when the institutions go down en masse, the effect then across the board, whether you're a small bank in Waverly that hasn't got any derivatives in their portfolio, suddenly may be equally disastrous because they've made loans for six small shopping centers that have various kinds of tenants, some of which now go out of business. So when you're in a recession, the right answer isn't to say, we're in a recession, a banker won't make a loan here, why should we be involved to try to pump up the economy? It's the government, it's a false truism to say we're like a household. And a household, when it doesn't have enough money, has to tighten it down. We're not a household, we're a country, we're an economy. And when an economy is in a downward spiral, stimulus measures that turn that around and put it into an upward spiral and bring back into use unused resources, put people back to work, has an overall long-term positive and dynamic benefit. And this particular sector is so much worse off than the economy as a whole. In our state, I think, yes, in some sections of building, because there is excess product, single-family homes would be an example, but in a lot of areas, there is an excess product. And we are not building homes, and as a result, a lot more people want to rent, and rental occupancies are 97% in most subparts of the market, but it's still hard to finance rental projects. And we have a number of examples like that. Institutional uses like medical facilities. A lot of projects have been put on the shelf to wait to happen later. Senior projects, which there is strong demand. I have had several of them where the clients were ready to proceed last fall, and then with the elimination of this 501c3 market, those projects aren't going forward. Now, is there an alternative path for some of them? Yes, FHA insurance on the loan is an alternative possibility, but that's a 6 to 9 month processing period. And an alternative that would potentially open up that market would be a good way to make some of those things happen. Why the banks are wanting to lend 50 to 60%? Frankly, my view is that a lot of lending is like the behavior of lemmings. If everybody's doing it, it must be good. You want to be a participant in that condo project in Uptown in Minneapolis. When real estate is bad, instead of thinking, gee, maybe there's still some niches that make sense, or we ought to be lending like we have historically at 75% loan to value, underwriting top, but doing some project, they say no. All of a sudden, all real estate will never do more than 50%. And I think that when you're at that kind of level, you cannot get the equity returns on the project to generate an amount of equity sufficient to make the deal happen. And you have to have some gap fillers.
Okay, and I'm going to just screw it on everyone here and tell you, and we're going to go back to us in the evening, but we've been on this phone for almost 2 hours, and the PAC conference committee is waiting for us to adjourn. And we have a lot more questions, and so we're going to do all the questions we have. We just want shorter answers and shorter questions. So, shorter questions, both sides here. So, I want to go back to Representative Eastland because I with this, just for the advocates to have to know, and I want to thank a number of advocates here who have very publicly supported tax increases. And unlike the federal government, who can do all this stimulus and bail things out, like was just stated, they have to do it without raising taxes. We can't. The only way we can do any of this is with a signed revenue-raising bill. It's just a fact. I think there's a bunch of folks who know that the likelihood of that isn't that great. So you can't buy any new things without revenue. It's just a fact. All the fiscal chairs, except a couple, are cutting. And if the governor doesn't sign the House 1.5 or the Senate 2.2, we're going to cut more. So the Congress can do all these things without raising taxes. We, on the other hand, would have to raise taxes to pay for this bill. So we, and you may not know that we heard no bills this year that had spending items without a tax increase to pay for them. We're hearing this only because the Senate is pursuing it. Everybody on both sides of the aisle here, and both sides of the aisle have bills here that have lots of great ideas, and we have the historic credit bill in this committee with authors in this committee, and we have a lot of these ideas here, and we did not hear them because unless those authors raised the tax to pay for it, we wouldn't hear them. So folks need to know that whether it's this one or all the other ones being considered in tax conference committee, Mr. Cashney had quite a night last night in the tax conference committee and their provision, without new revenue, none of these will become law. So I hope the coalition understands that to get this done, you need revenue raising. And I know a bunch of the coalition is very publicly for it. I also know a bunch of the coalition opposes tax increases. So I think folks got to get their heads around that too, because new spending isn't going to happen this year without new revenue. So, that's going to be.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I think I heard you say is that we got here because we hyper-stimulated the health sector. That's really what happened over the last 10 years, and we had some of the, there are probably well that happened. We had some of the best times in construction that we've ever had, as we've seen. My question is it realistic to think that the last 10 years should be the benchmark for where we are in the construction industry? I'm not sure it is, Michael. And to say that because the construction industry is down now compared to what it was 5 years ago, and we need to get it back there, I'm not sure that's an assumption that I agree with. Banks have one thing that they've always wanted to do. They want to make money. And they want to make money today. They want to make loans today. But they want to make loans if they know they're going to make money. Interest has never been cheaper. Money has never been cheaper than it is today. And so to actually factor that into what it was a few years ago, I mean, there probably is a benefit there as well. But I guess I'm just struggling with the fact that somehow we just came out of a 10-year cycle that was really caused by intervention in the whole lending market. And now the solution somehow is to do that. And I can't philosophically get my hands around that and think that's something that we should do just kind of at the end of the session because somehow we believe in our hearts that it's going to make a difference. I'm not sure if they're making it. And I guess that's what I'm about.
Thank you.
Person
Maury,
then
Downey.
You said that the CHIP didn't affect our budget, but I was
thinking it does. Yeah, I was corrected. The PTR, that's right. There would be a, and that's not on the fiscal revenue estimate yet.
Oh.
I don't believe it. Yes, there would be a state cost to the increased need for property tax refunds due to the property tax increase that would take place as a result of that provision. So you're right, Rep. Miller.
Then I agree with you on having at least $1 billion. At least half those in the billion are in the bond interest is really difficult. I guess maybe my question maybe for Mr. Michael, have we ever, I've been 15 years, I've never seen anything where we gave funding to something we didn't know what was going to and whether it fits in the state purposes or, I'm just looking at this, I can see a stadium, a racetrack, a casino,
Who said I?
I mean, if I vote for something other than a casino and a stadium, then my district, or the state, I think I'm a stadium full of my district, which is the second most anti in the state of the current closest. I was wondering, do we have a large record of doing major projects that we don't even know whether they can put in state policy? Or
Mr. Michael.
I'm just wondering what I'm getting into here.
Madam Chair, Representative Mulery, in most of these things, with the loan guarantee program, for example, is not really explicitly a tax program. It does have a tax feature because the sales tax is dedicated. My recollection, and this is, again, not a tax program, so the tax committee never dealt with it, but my recollection was that in the middle to early 80s that there was a program, much smaller scope than this, that was sort of similar, that was, I think, called MEDA or something like that, that was in the old, what I think was then even DEED, that was sort of a general authority to help finance, sort of business development projects that was not sort of specific to this project, this specific test project, or that type of project. I don't know that that ever really had a big scope, but I know that that was sort of authorized sometime in the 80s.
Representative Mueller, can I ask Mr. Michael further on that? I mean, my understanding was that no one really used it, though, right? I mean, weren't all those tax credits repealed because it didn't even work? Isn't that right?
Madam Chair, I'm not. There were tax credits that were also enacted in the 80s. Okay. This was a separate program that was run by the Economic Development Agency that involved issuing. At that time, it was much easier to issue tax-exempt bonds, and so it had a component of issuing tax-exempt bonds, and I believe it had a loan guarantee component to it, but I might be wrong about that. And of course, for the state, you always have to fund loan guarantees because you can't lend the state's credit because of our constitutional restrictions. So you always have to have a fund of money that's there that the lender will say, I see that the state has appropriated money that we can call on. But my recollection was that there was some general purpose kind of program a little bit similar to that back in, of course, that too was a deep recession period. But I don't know the details. I never worked on it. I don't really know.
I could see small projects that don't interfere with state policy.
Jim, more.
A little worried about that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, just a quick process question. Are we actually voting on?
Well, we're going to.
This is just a hearing.
We're going to try to wrap up because we already passed the omnibus tax bill. It's gone.
Right.
And we did the flood item because that, I think people recognize is a problem. And I think Representative Lang, Representative Mark, are working with Chief Appeller and hold them there to see if they can find the resources to help those communities. But beyond that, no, we're hearing this because the Senate has stated into the microphone during PAC conference committee they intend to put this bill into their side of the Senate, the tax omnibus bill. So what we tried to do this year, Representative Downey, Ms. Carlson-Walrus really tried hard to track every bill the Senate was hearing that we were missing and tried to hear them. And in fact, many of them we heard for the 6 days. We heard the governor's bill because lots of people carry those. And so we tried really hard to make sure that we knew everything the Senate was thinking about. And this is one of the very few items that we did not have a hearing on due to its late arrival. But the Senate is at least publicly has stated they intend to try to get the House to do it. And I'm trying to gauge how the House Tax Committee feels about this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were going to actually be voting on this. Contemplating an oil amendment, but pretty close. There are a couple of sections I would look at. So I'll just be on the record for the benefit of your position going forward as opposing this bill in its kind of current form and in its entirety. And I know within the tax committee box, tax credits look on the ledger sheet a lot like this, but there is a huge difference between allowing somebody to hold on to their money as compared to us taking state treasury and deploying it in this kind of a venture. Those two are fundamentally different in my mind. And kind of Keynesian economic philosophy aside, I think, as Representative Eastland pointed out, I think we're venturing into a market that is very uncertain. And for us to go in on the heels of everything that's happened over the last couple of years, where we've seen the unintended consequences of government intervention, and where we're going to now take another edge of risk off of private sector transactions and encourage riskier behavior in the marketplace as a result, I just think that's a huge mistake, and I would want to love to have the chance to vote against it, to be on the record being against it, but I'll let my comments suffice and understand where I am on the bill going forward there.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Further discussion? Is that it? Because we are actually getting done with this one, and we appreciate that you've all sat here. And if that meant, with that members, Representative Reiner moves the main discussion minutes. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Members, thank you for your time. We are adjourned.